You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Mary Olenchuk. Mary was a 13-year-old girl enjoying her summer vacation in Maine when she would decide to take a short trip to the store to purchase candy and a newspaper. Mary wouldn't make it home from that trip. And after an intentional two-day delay by investigators to inform the public that Mary was missing, a massive search to include the military was conducted. Despite their best efforts, it was discovered that Mary had been murdered, and 53 years later, her case still remains unsolved. In 1970, Mary Catherine Olenchuk was 13 years old. She was a homebody who enjoyed hanging out at home with family. She was the youngest of three sisters, and her father, Peter Olenchuk, was an army general. In the summers, Mary's family would vacation in a seaside resort in Ogunquit, where they owned a summer house on Israel Head Road about 12 miles from Kennebunk, Maine. Mary, a freckled-faced, blue-eyed, natural redhead, loved to collect seashells by the shore and trade them with her friends. Wherever Mary went, her large English red setter was sure to follow her. Whether Mary was riding her bike or walking through the village streets, her dog was always at her side. The two were inseparable. Mary and her family lived in Illinois, where her father was stationed. In Illinois, Mary attended a Roman Catholic school and was described by her parents as, quote, very pleasant, very quiet, very agreeable child, unquote. Mary spent her summer days with a routine of doing household chores in the morning before spending her afternoons on the beach. Residents of the little seaside village that summer would say they considered Mary a fixture in their summer scenes. Mary was often recognized in town as she was friendly with everybody, and she was always with her beloved dog, who was also a redhead. Sunday, August 9th, started out like any other summer day for Mary. Mary, her mother, and sister would head to the beach that morning to soak up the last of the summer days. Mary would spend her afternoon on the beach searching for shells that she could trade. Mary rode a neighbor's bike, a black Hercules English racing bike with wire saddlebag holders, that afternoon to the beach. And of course, her English setter came trotting along behind her. Later that afternoon, Mary would decide to head back home. She would jump on the bicycle and her dog would follow her home. Mary would make it home from the beach to change out of her swimsuit into a pair of faded pink shorts and a white t-shirt. After she was dressed, she decided to ride into town and buy candy and a newspaper. Mary again would borrow her neighbor's bike and head towards the store. Around 4:30 p.m., visitors on the porch of the Marginal Way house saw Mary and her dog go by, and they waved hello to her. Mary then would turn on Shore Road to Israel Head Drive right outside the Lookout Hotel when a maroon car would pull up to the sidewalk and catch Mary's attention. Later, Mary's family and friends would say it must have been someone Mary knew because she climbed off the bicycle, propping it under the arch of the Lookout Hotel, and got into the maroon car with her dog, and was seen driving away with this person smiling. She was just 200 yards from her own front door. There was an elderly woman, a resident of the Lookout Hotel, who was on the third floor, that would tell investigators what she had witnessed. She said August 9th, around 5 p.m. when she looked out her window, she would see Mary talking with a man in dark clothing. When she looked again, the car was moving out of the driveway and Mary seemed to be laughing as they drove away. She told investigators that the man looked to be about 30. Around 7 p.m. when Mary hadn't returned home, her mother and sister had already walked the streets looking for her. That is when Mary's mother would make the decision to report Mary missing. Police were quick to respond and took Mary's case very seriously as she was a general's daughter. However, the police did keep Mary's disappearance from the community very quiet until Tuesday, the 11th. Police Chief Perkins said they had made that decision in case the kidnapper that had abducted Mary would call the family asking for some kind of ransom. Despite the decision to keep the public in the dark about Mary's disappearance, investigators would still assemble a small search team, which by 11 p.m., August 9th, would find the bicycle Mary was riding earlier under the arch of the Lookout Hotel. They also found her drawstring shoulder bag that she generally carried containing a pack of gum, which she had told her family that she had wanted to get earlier, which led investigators to believe that she did make it to the store and was heading back home before being abducted. Mary's family was well known in the area and highly respected. Many of the residents of the village would see Mary out on summer days with her dog and wave to her as she passed. So when it was discovered that she was missing, the community was in shock. When investigators interviewed those in town and discovered that Mary seemed to be willing to get into this vehicle, investigators explained this to Mary's father, who responded, quote, "She would have had to have known that person to have gotten in the car," unquote. Police Chief Carl Perkins worked the case as an abduction right away. This wasn't a case where they thought, well, maybe Mary had run away and would return at some point. This case they took very seriously from the beginning. And part of me believes it's because her father was a general and because they were in such a wealthy area. And it makes me wonder if that's why they kept her abduction quiet for 48 hours before really diving in and speaking to everyone in town. Was that a missed opportunity in this investigation? Honestly, we'll never know. Mary's father, General Peter Olenchuk, would fly in from Maryland Air Force Base to New Hampshire Air Force Base Sunday night. The community and investigators were quick to search the area and set up a ground search of surrounding areas. The FBI already let investigators know that they had 4 agents ready to assist if at any point it was determined that a federal statute had been violated. On August 12th, an air search was conducted, assisted by Army helicopters, which arrived from Fort Devens, Massachusetts. From the air, 225 abandoned cars would be pinpointed to be searched, as well as any buildings of interest, and there were no signs of Mary. Despite investigators being called in very quickly and taking this case very seriously from the jump, it would be Friday when police would gather enough information out of interviews with residents to realize that they weren't just looking for a maroon car, they were looking for one with scratches and dents. Investigators thought this was a really great lead that was going to help get them closer to finding this car. So they started checking with gas stations and body shops and businesses around and asking if they had seen a maroon vehicle with either scratches in the hood or the fender. And unfortunately, no one after Sunday had seen this vehicle. By August 18th, the search had covered the Wells region and the coastal area of York County. Investigators were asking the public if they were on Short Road in Ogunquit, August 9th, between 4:30 and 6 p.m., if any of them saw a faded maroon car break out of the coastal line of traffic onto Israel Road to contact them. Investigators said because of how heavy the traffic in that area would be on a Sunday, the car would have had to break that line of traffic to go either north or south, and it would be an obvious breakaway. Shore Road was the last road Mary was seen traveling on, which connects to Israel Head, where her house is. Shore Road itself links to U.S. Route 1, which can take you south to Boston or north to Portland. And the original witness, the woman in the hotel who police have said that they will keep her identity hidden, saw the maroon car come off of US 1 onto Shore Road back into the driveway of the Lookout Hotel before interacting with Mary. Investigators were hoping that now that they shared this information with the public, this would be the break they were looking for. But unfortunately, no one came forward to say that they remembered a maroon car breaking away from the traffic on August 9th. As the story of a missing general's daughter began hitting airwaves, more and more papers in the surrounding states were picking up the story. By August 14th, reporters were now camped outside of Mary's home. On August 13th, General Olenchuk would have briefly appear at his front door to let reporters know that they had no comment to make and that he was cooperating with the Attorney General's department and the police. Reporters stated that while General Olenchuk remained pleasant, he told photographers he wouldn't be posing for photos, but they could take as many pictures of their home as they wished. What made the search for Mary so challenging was the summer resort they were vacationing in could have an average of around 20,000 tourists a day in that area. So while you had visitors that owned homes like Mary's family, you also had an additional 20,000 plus tourists that were staying for the weekend, just for the day, for the week, for the summer. It made it very challenging to find Mary and especially who took her. August 20th, 11 days into the search, and Mary's father would finally decide to grant the press an interview. Many in the press had been speculating that Mary's disappearance might have something to do with the general's military record. After speaking with investigators, General Olenchuk would decide it was best to put these rumors to rest so that reporters could get to focusing on the facts about Mary's disappearance. A press conference would be set up at the Wells Grange Hall, where the general confirmed reports that he had been in charge of a shipment of nerve gas from Alabama to Kentucky to Sunny Point, North Carolina. That gas was then sunk earlier in the week aboard an old Liberty ship 283 miles off of Cape Kennedy. I have so many questions about this, but that's not what this is about, so we're just going to skim past that. General Olenchuk would tell the press that any connection between Mary's disappearance and his assignment had been deeply investigated and discounted within the first few days of Mary's disappearance, which may have played a role again why they kept her disappearance so quiet in those first few days. The general would go on to explain that in his everyday job, he heads the Army's Procurement and Supply Agency in Joliet, Illinois. He explained that he was only chosen for the nerve gas assignment because of his chemical corpse background and had not been notified that he had been selected until 2 days before Mary's disappearance. The reason the general wasn't with his family at the time of Mary's disappearance was because he had been flown to Alabama a few days prior to supervise the loading and security of the nerve gas. The general would be notified of Mary's disappearance while on this assignment and would fly to Maine to be with his wife and daughters. Mary had one other sister still at home, and her oldest sister lived in Boston and was married, but she also would fly out once she found out about Mary's disappearance and come to Maine to support her family. The general would ask the public to please provide any information that could lead to the return of his daughter, saying, quote, "No matter how unimportant the information may seem, it's been 11 days since any member of our family has seen or heard from our youngest daughter, Mary. I know I don't need to tell you what my family has been going through. All of you who have children or brothers and sisters know," unquote. The general said that he didn't believe his daughter would run away from home. Mary and his other daughters had been warned not to talk with strangers, and he felt that if she did stop to talk with this stranger, then, quote, "she either had confidence in the individual or knew him," unquote. The general went on to explain that they had spent the last three summers together for their family vacation in Ogunquit, and that Mary was familiar with the area and truly loved fishing. The general would go on to praise the work of the Maine State Police, the Ogunquit Police, and the FBI, and all those assisting in the case to help bring his daughter home. The general said that if by the end of the summer there was no developments in the search for Mary, he and his family will be returning to Joliet. 12 days into the search, helicopters were still being used to search the coastline, and two army jeeps were covering back roads in the Wells, Ogunquit, York area. Some things I noticed while searching Mary's case, but I have also seen in others, is that they want to make it very clear that Mary was not interested or involved with boys. It was a constant thing that they felt like they had to insert into so many articles about her disappearance. They wanted the public to know that she was still interested in dogs and hanging out with her sisters and her family, and that she did not walk away with a boy, and there was no boy involved in her disappearance. Maybe it's because this case took place in the 70s, so that's why they felt like they had to protect her honor and make sure she was projected as a good girl so people would help find her. I just found it very interesting how often, from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, parents feel like they have to defend who their kids are, as if they understand there's an assigned value to each missing child. The search for Mary would end on the 14th day, with her body being discovered beneath a pile of hay in a deserted barn in Kennebuck, about 6 miles from her family's summer home in Ogunquit. This deserted barn is located between U.S. Route 1 and 9 near a river. It would be Saturday when the assistant caretaker of the Riverhurst Estate, Peter Gunn, along with three other estate workers, noticed around noon a distinct strong odor. That's when the three of them would go to investigate, and they would discover Mary beneath the hay with a rope wrapped around her neck. While of course they would have to wait for a full positive identification, and they were still waiting on records coming from Juliet as far as her dental and fingerprint records, in the meantime, they felt comfortable telling Mary's family and reporters that they believe they had found Mary. Mary's remains would be taken to an autopsy performed by the state pathologist, Dr. Goodoff. Decomposition had sat in, which was making it challenging for them to pinpoint the exact day of her death. But at this point, officers had the assumption that it was most likely the day that she was abducted that she was murdered. Investigators explained that the area that the barn is in, the surrounding area, can be very popular to fishers and campers, but as far as the barn itself, it's far off the road, and to locals, you would have to know it's there to go there. As always, I will be putting pictures up on my socials and the Sipping on Some Crime website for those that are interested. From the pictures, it's clear to see how secluded this barn was. When you look at the pictures of the barn, this barn was pretty far off the road, and there's these massive, and I mean massive, trees that almost completely engulfed the barn. And it's so far from the main house on the property that most likely no one really went out there other than the caretakers. This led investigators and locals to believe that this had to be someone familiar with this property. Unbeknownst to many of the locals, because it was the 1970s, and we just weren't as connected as far as news outside of our local state, unless stories like Mary's grabbed national attention. New Hampshire and Massachusetts had similar disappearances with girls around the same age as Mary, and wanted to speak with investigators that were working Mary's case. State Police Lieutenant Charles Burton would tell the Evening Express August 26th that no positive connections have been made with any other case. He said those cases included a case of a 13-year-old girl out of Cape Elizabeth who was approached August 7th at Higgins Beach by a man fitting the description of the suspect last seen with Mary. Burton would go on to say that the story of the Cape Elizabeth girl is, however, one of the many cases being checked out by police investigators. On August 23rd, investigators picked up a hitchhiker fitting the general description of the man last seen talking to Mary and was being held by Kittery police for questioning. At the time, investigators weren't saying whether that had anything to do with Mary's case. This property and area around the barn had been searched in the initial ground search. There is not great details on why this barn wasn't looked at, if it was looked at, and why, if it was searched, Mary wasn't found sooner. But investigators do admit that they had been at this property more than once in the 14 days leading up to finding Mary's body in the barn. State Police, Ogunquit, and Kennebec Police, along with the York County Sheriff's Office, set up roadblocks around the property to keep curious onlookers from entering. They wanted to do the best they could to secure the scene and get as much evidence as they could, despite the fact that the previous week there had been fishers and campers in the surrounding area. Investigators spread out and made an extensive search of the area surrounding the building, looking for clues. The old barn has been out of commission in the 70s for over 50 years, so it wasn't in the best condition. It was located on a part of the property that nobody went, and it was very dark and gloomy inside, so they did have to bring floodlights in to be able to really investigate the inside of the barn. So hopefully that'll give you a better picture of how much these trees swallowed this barn and surrounded it, that it made it so dark inside the barn, even in the bright daylight. Investigators would also search the river close by, looking for any evidence or clues. While investigators said that they weren't positive of any links between the Cape Elizabeth attempted abduction and Mary's case, they were exploring possible links of two other cases in bordering states. In Boxford, Massachusetts, investigators were still looking for who was responsible for the murder and abduction of Michelle Wilson, 13, in November of 1969. While in New Hampshire, police were looking for the person responsible for the abduction and murder of Debbie Lee Horn, whose body would be discovered 7 months after she disappeared in 1969. Police Chief Charles R. Burton, the commanding officer of the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, would say early on in the investigation that at this point, the departments are just sharing information between one another. At this time, there is no definitive links to all three cases, but they will be sharing information with each other moving forward. Temporary headquarters were set up at the Kittery Barracks, where police and army personnel had been conducting their search from and would continue to conduct their investigation in those first few weeks from that temporary headquarters. Despite a full confirmation of the remains belonging to Mary, her family did plan funeral services for their daughter. Investigators and family were positive on identification because of the fact that when Mary left the beach that day, she was wearing faded pink shorts and a white t-shirt that said Andrews Air Force Base. And that, along with other belongings of Mary's, were found with her remains. Mr. and Mrs. Olenchuk would release a statement through the press Air Force Base requesting that in lieu of flowers, contributions be made to Mary Catherine Olenchuk's Memorial Fund to be used for scholarship assistance for students pursuing studies in music. Mary's funeral was scheduled for August 25th, 1970, and while her family mourned the passing of Mary, investigators were hard at work searching southern Maine's coastal communities for a dark-haired man in his mid-20s to early 30s. Besides the maroon car, which one witness saw Mary get into, they had described it as a Chevy with scratches and dents, but some articles would say that it was scratches and dents on the hood, and some would say fenders. But we do know that there was a maroon vehicle, most likely a Chevy model, that was scratched and dented somewhere on the body, and that the driver was likely a man with dark hair in his early 20s to 30s. That was the only tip these officers had to work with. The Maine State Police Chief Parker Hennessy said, quote, "We're pulling out all the stops and putting every available man we need to into this case," unquote. Assistant Attorney Richard Cohen said seven state police detectives in total were taking part of the investigation. At this point, they were able to report that the autopsy showed that Mary died from strangulation caused by a rope being tightly wrapped around her neck. Due to decomposition, they couldn't, nor were they willing to say at this point, whether Mary had been sexually assaulted. Despite the massive manhunt and their best efforts, 6 months later, in February 1971, they were no closer to discovering who abducted and murdered Mary. And now, as Mary's story got bigger and papers were continuously connecting her murder to other murders in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, many people were demanding answers. Locals in three states were starting to feel like their missing and murdered girls could all be connected. They called it the Triangle of Mystery, saying that the murder of two girls in southern Maine, the strange death of a New Hampshire girl, and two other murders within a small triangular area over the last 2 years may be the doing of one person. In 1971, the focus wasn't just trying to solve Mary's case, but now police really had to look at Massachusetts and New Hampshire for possible clues. Deborah Horn, 11 of Allentown, New Hampshire, and Michelle Wilson, 13 of Brunswick, their cases had similarities to Mary's. While investigators admit there are some similarities, those similarities were not enough to lead the police to a suspect. Investigators also wanted to make it clear that even though all of these murders were within a reasonable distance of each other, in fact, they are within a day's drive of one another, that this could still be the possibility that it's just coincidental. Perkins would tell investigators in February 1971 that he still has men working on the case and that this case is, quote, a backbreaker, unquote. He said at this point, you could write a novel on the theories alone. Since August of 1970, they said there had been so many suspects questioned. In the beginning, one of their suspects was a man who seemed to show more than a passing interest in Mary that resided in the seaside town at the time. However, it seems like investigators eventually ruled him out. Another suspect was questioned and cleared, and months later took his own life. There was another suspect, a resident who actually requested and obtained a lie detector test when suspicion by locals were pointed at him, and investigators would say that test cleared him. The RCMP in Edmonton began paying attention to Mary's case because of the similar case they had in their own neighborhood. The RCMP believed both their case and Mary's could be the work of a sex fiend. However, investigators would make it clear that there is no evidence in sexual assault of all cases everyone's trying to connect, mainly because two of the victims, one being Mary's, state of decomposition when found, wouldn't allow a complete toxicology and sexual assault examination. However, there was similarities between the death of Michelle Wilson and Mary, being that they were both struck over the heads before their death. 6 months later, investigators were not only trying to figure out who killed Mary, but were perplexed by what would have made her get into that car with that stranger. Could it have been that he wasn't a stranger to her? And if he was, what did he say that made her feel safe enough to get in that car? August 1971, on the one-year anniversary since the abduction and murder of Mary, Captain Millard Nickerson, director of the State Police Criminal Division, said in a press conference, quote, "We haven't given up. We keep up on this thing full tilt and spent thousands of man hours and traveled hundreds of miles on this case," unquote. Detective Sherwood Baston at this time was a 15-year police veteran that was assigned to Mary's case full-time. A year in, and he was just one of the half dozen detectives working on the investigation from the very beginning and were maintaining cooperation with departments like the FBI and checked out suspects who lived as far away as Florida and California. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP, were also still looking closely at Mary's case as they believe it's very similar to three homicides in the Maritime Provinces. Nickerson said, quote, The Mounties have been here and we've been there several times going over the details of these murders, unquote. Detective Baston had said, up to this point, hundreds of persons had been interviewed and they had built an index file of all those involved, which filled up an entire file cabinet drawer. Lieutenant Charles Burton, Chief of Homicide Squad, recently formed by the Attorney General's office, said, when it comes to getting Mary's case, quote, the older they get, the harder they are to solve, but we never get completely cold on this one. We've kept it going steadily and plan to continue, unquote. In September 1971, a fire would destroy the barn where Mary's remains were found and once again would bring Mary's case to the forefront of everyone's minds. Despite the press coverage that Mary's case held strong for 2 years, mainly due to the fact that many believe that her case was involved with other cases from New Hampshire to Canada, her coverage is almost non-existent until August 9, 1980, 10 years after Mary's murder. On August 9, 1980, the Morning Sentinel newspaper would run the headline, Police Have Suspect in 1970 Slaying. Assistant Attorney General Pat Perino would tell reporters that they believe the last 10 years of tips have led them to the person they believe is responsible for Mary's murder. Perino would say while they have a suspect, there has never been enough evidence for a conviction, and the case is, quote, not very active, unquote. Investigators would not identify who this suspect was or confirm whether he is still living in Maine. They would say that detectives were able to link him to the case several years after Mary's death, but have yet to approach him for questioning. Detective James Pinnett said that it's a difficult one. Things have come up, but nothing that has ever been good enough to shed any new light on Mary's case. By 1980, Mary's parents lived in a suburb outside of D.C. and continued to decline to discuss Mary's case with reporters. The investigation into Mary's case would grow beyond cold. It would be lost in time. In August 2000, 30 years after, it became one of the oldest unsolved homicides in Maine. Detective Jeffrey Smith was assigned to Mary's case and had her file for just about a year when he told reporters, quote, unfortunately, like wine, homicides do not get better with age, unquote. Detective Smith highlights the fact that Mary's killer still being at large shows proof of the need of a cold case squad in Maine, a unit that would work exclusively on unsolved homicides. Legislators spoke of considering creating such a unit when it convenes the following year in 2001. In 2002, the much desperately needed cold case unit had still not been established in Maine, like so many had hoped. The previous October, a Maine State Police detective was interviewed and accepted the position for the cold case unit, only to see the position frozen before he could even begin. Alec Ferguson, a reporter for the Portland Press Herald, wrote an article May 22, 2002, expressing the citizens of Maine's frustration of so many unsolved cases and having no unit dedicated to handling it. Instead, they felt like their current governor was pushing to spend $3 million to tear down an old prison in Thomaston, yet was holding back the $100,000 that would be needed to fund the cold case unit. Ferguson pointed out that not only was Mary's case beyond cold, but a year later after Mary's disappearance, Judith Hand from Farmington, 15 years old, would disappear and be found a few weeks later in a sawdust pile, and her case would also still remain unsolved. And that's just the tip of around 70 cases at that time in the state of Maine still unsolved, to include cases like Alice Lothrop, Joseph Albert, Ashley Owlett, and so many more. The community was frustrated that the Attorney General's office, state police, and criminal justice committee legislator, along with the Senate, had created this legislation and allocated the funds to give the state a cold case unit, only to watch the funding be frozen by budget shortfalls. It would be 2015 when the 127th legislator approved funding for an unsolved homicide unit. And now, with the 75 unsolved cases that Maine had, it was desperately needed. Many locals believe that since Mary went willingly with this person and her father and family were adamant that she didn't have any boyfriend, that investigators should have spent time focusing on those local and close to Mary, even to include investigating her family. Did waiting days to interview the public about Mary's disappearance mean they lost crucial time to collect more eyewitnesses and evidence? That we will never know. It's really easy to sit here 53 years later and look at the case and say all the things that we would have done differently. But none of that really matters in the end. What matters in the end is, despite the failures in Mary's case, it shouldn't still be sitting unsolved in 2023. From what I understand, Mary's dog was never seen again. I cannot find confirmation of what happened to her dog. I know listeners have been thinking about this the whole time, and I was digging in hopes to be able to give you at least a resolution with Mary's dog, that maybe the dog had come home safe, but I can't even offer you that. Mary was so young, and she had so much more life to live. And that was all stolen from her at the end of the summer on a weekend in front of thousands of people. To this day, we only have one verified witness and very few descriptors of the person responsible for abducting and murdering Mary. The barn is gone. Many of those who investigated this crime from the beginning are gone. Many of those witnesses are gone, and many of Mary's family members since then have passed on, and yet this case still needs to be solved. Could Mary's case be linked to other cases leading all the way up to Canada? Is it possible? Absolutely. But I wanted this episode to focus on Mary's case individually because every single case deserves that, which is why I didn't spend much time diving into the other cases. I didn't want them to distract from Mary, and with not enough information and proof pointing to them actually being connected, I wanted this episode to remain on what investigators reported as confirmed facts in Mary's case. I know this was a complicated one and that cases featuring children are really hard for a lot of people to listen to. So thank you for those that listened, and please share Mary's story in any format that you feel comfortable with, to include word of mouth. Somebody knows something. And word of mouth and advancements in forensic technology will be what solves these cases. I do believe Mary's case can be solved, and I hope more creators pick up her story and continue to share her face. If you are listening on Apple or Spotify, please hit that subscribe button and leave a review. That does help bring cases like Mary's to more ears. Don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.